Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Creator Spotlight here on the Spotlight and Fightful. I am Steven Jensen, joined as always by Jeremy Lambert. And our guest today is one of the voices of my childhood. You know him from WCW and TNA Wrestling. He also has a new book out called Sitting Ringside, Volume 1. It's by David Penzer and Guy Evans. Our guest today, of course, is David Penzer. Thanks for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, so are we. As I mentioned, you are a voice of my childhood. I grew up in the 90s, just like Jeremy. We're late 80s kids, grew up throughout the Monday Night Wars and everything. So you are a person that I saw on my TV screen growing up, and it's an honor to have you on, man. What's it like all these years later, you know, talking about WCW still to this day?
It's crazy, man. And, you know, I call it the improbable, impossible journey. If you know, wrestling's changed a lot, but back in 1990, they didn't let people that didn't have wrestling experience or referee experience into the backstage area. It just didn't happen. So many things had to go right. So many people had to see something in me that probably wasn't there. So it's just 30 years later, to, you know, I talk about it in the book, the whole journey, but when I started it, it was almost like, how do I keep this going another day? How do I keep this going another week? 30 years later here, and I'm so blessed to just have it keep going. It's crazy.
In starting with WCW, I know that you get into it in the book, but I want to touch on something you just said about people saw something in you that maybe you didn't see. When did you start to see it? And was there a moment, or maybe somebody said something of like, hey, you got this, like you can do this, you're good?
You know, Jody Hamilton believed in me, the masked assassin. He was ironically one of my favorite wrestlers growing up, watching championship wrestling from Florida in the 1970s. And he didn't so much say it, but his confidence of bringing me back every week and letting me be around the guys and pick up tasks, like I call it stooging around, you know, sign in sheets and running guys for interviews. And, you know, after a little while, once they keep bringing you back and what, you know, once you know, they could stay, you know, Jody basically said, you know, plan on coming back unless I call you and tell you not to. Well, then you sort of get a feeling that maybe, you know, this improbable thing might end up working out, but I'm still not anywhere close to being in front of a microphone at that point, but still, you know, I'm there and I'm working, you know, I'm, you know, bringing guys up and, you know, stooging around. So that's probably when.
Yeah. I've actually heard old interviews. I guess they're old already at this point, years back, about you talking about those days of you being a stooge, you know, kind of as you're, when you're getting your feet wet and, kind of earning your place in WCW. And I know that.
The boss pops in.
Listen, I am illegally doing this while driving.
What an honor I get. The big boss pops in.
Give me a ring announcement.
I'm going to tell
you. You didn't even announce me properly. I show up here with no introduction whatsoever, with a legendary ring announcer. What kind of treatment is this?
Better than you got from Triple H.
I don't. That dude sent me cheese. What are you sending me?
Really?
Did they send you cheese? Is that a true story?
Yes.
He posted it. He posted it.
Yes, he sent me cheese.
That, but I figured that can't possibly be right. That's tremendous.
No, they did. Why would I lie about that?
I thought you were just real. I thought it was like an inside joke or something.
It's so funny because most of the people in the wrestling business thought that I was ribbing them. I wasn't. They sent me cheese.
I thought it was somebody.
I wonder what Mike Johnson got.
Cheese. He got it too. We showed each other our notes.
That's funny.
Sean, I gotta hop off here. I'm about to lose service.
Thanks for showing up.
Sean's gonna get into an accident. There you go, David. You were giving us some hell offline there. I delivered on Sean Ross Sapp for you.
I got the true story on the cheese.
Yes.
That's a scoop. That's an important scoop there.
That's tremendous.
Yes. What was I just talking about?
Why not pick I don't know. Why not pick like cupcakes or steaks, like Omaha steaks or something?
I have the scoop on this, and it is because Sean said after the press conference and after everything had happened, he said, "I would like a gift basket of the finest French cheeses as an apology."
Ah.
So he got the finest Connecticut cheeses, I guess. So there you go.
In all fairness to those guys, knowing Triple H a little, I haven't spoken to him in 25 years, but getting to know him a little bit, I think he was more trying to like get the guy off the hook who was mumbling and bumbling than he was trying to insult anybody, in all fairness.
Yeah. The question, Lucas, he does a great job. I don't want to say anything bad about him, but he was the framing of the question wasn't the best with that. And then I think Triple H was, Triple H answered the way he answered. I'm not going to say anything.
When it was also the press conference was over, it was done. And they were like, we'll take one more question just because we got a little extra time. And then that was the question. And I think that was that irritated him, that he was I'm going to stick around extra. And you're going to ask me that. You only wanted a softball to go out.
Well, don't do these press conferences if you just.
Yeah, but a lot of time in the rest business, if I'm being honest, if somebody, a lot of times, Penzer said that? Why would you listen to a word Penzer said? You know what I mean? So that's the go-to kind of reaction in the wrestling business. So I don't think he meant anything by it. Like I said, I haven't spoke to the guy in 25 years, but I spent 3 months on the road with him when he first started, me and Pee Wee Anderson, when he was terrorizing. And, it didn't come off as mean-spirited to me. It came off as more of smiling when he said it. But he got his cheese, so God bless him.
Cheese and he got an apology note or a thank you note, some type of note there.
Yes.
Go ahead, Jensen. We were talking about stooging.
Yeah.
Gail Kim calls you a stooge, Penzer.
We thought about putting making the title of the book Stooge of the Year. Seriously, that was in serious consideration. There's a fine line between running errands and kissing ass. And I might have crossed over it a couple of times. But, back in the day, that's sort of what you had to do to make yourself valuable. You weren't a wrestler. The main stars didn't talk to me. I hung out with the enhancement guys I brought up. The main guys didn't. It's not like they walked around and introduced themselves to me. So it took a little while of them seeing me and seeing that I was doing stuff and seeing that they were bringing me back. And then finally, after about 6-8 weeks, some of the guys, Brad Armstrong, Tommy Rich, I would say Tracy Smothers was one of the first people that actually asked about me. And they would say, why you come here? What's your gimmick? And I'd tell them. And then Junkyard Dog named me Walking Man because all I did is walk around all day. And, eventually they took me in, but it took a while. It was a different business. You didn't go around hugging everybody that was in the locker room that you didn't know. So, but you got to stooge a little bit.
Now, there's a story I remember from years ago, and let me know an update to this here. So I remember, this is a long time ago, Al Snow talking about how you had stooged him because of like getting him to sign like the like enhancement talent contract that just everyone just signed so they'd be able to work on the show. And there was like miscommunication there, most likely. You had no ill will towards him. I heard a follow-up interview where you basically said, I'll be seeing him soon, and I plan to just like squash this because like we're friends, and like I think it's just all a big misunderstanding. Did you ever squash the beef with Al Snow?
Yeah, I had him on my podcast back a few years ago when I had a podcast. Yeah, it was a big total huge misunderstanding. You know, there's a sheet you have to sign. It basically is the sheet that says they could put you on TV forever and ever. It's the why that nobody could get compensated for anything on WWE Network or right. Peacock, whatever they're calling it these days, because of those sheets that I walked around signing. And everybody had to sign them, from Ric Flair to Rick, you know, Rick fill in the blank job guy, enhancement guy. And and that's also how you got paid. So you didn't get paid if your name wasn't on that list. You had to print your name and sign it. And that's why they wanted to make sure that you signed it, because the wrestler wanted to get paid and they wanted to make sure they were covered for you coming back and saying, I want more money because you're showing my match again. So he wanted to read it. Most people just signed it because they wanted to get paid. He wanted to read it, which is fine. And then I went over to Terry Taylor, who was in the same locker room, and I said, I really don't know about this sheet. I just walk around telling people to sign it so they could get paid. Maybe you want to go over there and explain to him, you know, what it is. If you know what it is, I don't know. He seems a little concerned with it. And, you know, it's above my pay grade. And, yeah, there was like huge heat. I didn't even know we had heat, but then word came out, you know, podcast started and word came out. And yeah, it was squashed in 30 seconds. It was a total misunderstanding.
That's good to know that was squashed. It just seemed like a misunderstanding. I mean, so I'm that's good. That's good to know. Go ahead, Jeremy. What's your next question?
I want to ask, we're going to talk a lot about the book, but one of the things that I found really interesting about the book, and I think it's a big selling point of the book, is the production notes from WCW events. And specifically, I think one thing that is highlighted is the production note.
Oh, do we lost?
Okay.
For a second.
Yeah.
You mentioned the production notes and then he cut out for just a second.
Yeah. So the production notes, specifically the production notes for like the final WCW, but I want to know what went into including this, and was this your decision, guy's decision, collaborative decision, and just the overall process of not only including the production notes, but gathering them and getting them together to put in the book.
Well, they're the actual formats of the show. And it's sort of cool to see the evolution of the format. You know, we got 1993 format where it's a one pager, you know, Bobby Eaton versus blank. And then Jody Hamilton would fill in the enhancement guy. You know, then you see the last Nitro format. And, you know, it's detailed production notes with what highlights of what the guys are going to say in their promos and stuff. So it's fun to see that. That's the whole reason this whole project started. I was cleaning out my desk and I found a file folder with all these old, crazy, never before seen rare formats going back to the 90s, 93, 95, 90, you know, the Thunder where David Arquette won the world title, the last Nitro, a bunch of stuff. And I figured that it probably would be something that people would want to see, but I didn't know how to, you know, get it out there. So I took a picture of one of the formats. Wasn't the last night show. That was no, we didn't say a word to anybody, not even to people that knew about the book about that until it came out, because we figured somewhere out there, someone else might have one. And if word got out, they were going to beat us to it. So that was like a blood oath secret. But, and I'm surprised that it hadn't gotten out, quite frankly. But I put something on Twitter, you know, any ideas what this is worth? I have 200 pages of them. They're rare, never before seen, how the sausage is made kind of stuff, which people really like, how the sausage is made. So guy reached out to me and said, give me a call in the morning. And I said, okay. So I called him and he said, we should do a scrapbook. We could put those formats out and, you know, you could tell stories about the guys in the formats. And I said, all right, that sounds like fun. So we started doing that. And I had never had any intention of doing my story on me, but guys started, you know, looking into my background and asking me some questions. And about 3 months in, he said to me, he said, I want to make it an autobiography. I said, with no format? And he said, no.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I don't know. We'll still have the formats in there, but it'll be like, you know, half autobiography and half, you know, bonus material. And, you know, thank God he's such a great writer. He really did wonders to my story. It's an interesting story, but the way he told it really weaved you in. I like to joke about the fact that, you know, I didn't see the book until about 3 weeks before it came out, and he would send me a chapter a night. And excuse me. Sorry about that.
Okay.
I like the third or fourth chapter in, I looked at my wife and I said, this is my life story and I can't wait to see what comes next. You know, I'm on the edge of my seat reading my story. He told it so great. And so thank God for him. He's brilliant. And so we kind of had two in one. And there are some bundles that you could get at davidpenzerbook.com, all one word, davidpenzerbook.com, where you receive actual printed out formats as opposed to just being in the book. A lot of people have told me that have ordered them that they're going to try to go to a WrestleCon or a StarCast and get Ric Flair and Sting to sign the format page with the last match ever in Nitro history, and then frame it and put it on their wall. So that's pretty cool. So if you want to go to davidpenzerbook.com to look at the bundles, and then, you know, the book could be picked up on Amazon if you're not interested in the bundles. But yeah, I'm excited. You know, people are into it. It's really get the word around, and people really like to see how the sausage is made, as I said.
Yeah, that's a really cool idea, getting that signed by Flair and Sting. That's going to be a really cool item. I got so many questions I could ask you because you were, you know, a part of WCW and TNA wrestling for so long in this wrestling industry. Just kind of in general, like, I know you started in WCW in the early 90s, so you were there to see wrestling, because I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, so I was, you know, a WCW kid 100%. And what was it like seeing that company go from like kind of like a Southern wrestling company to like the heights that it had in like the mid to late 90s, and just kind of like how popular wrestling got, just being like the airports and stuff, as like this became so popular from the time you got in up until like, you know, the 2000s.
Well, before I answer the question, I'll point out the obvious. Somewhere along the way, you went from an Atlanta guy to a Minnesota guy. But
yes. So this is my, yeah, but, good call. Good call. I still play the Rhodes guy though. So there you go.
Yeah, there you go. But, the answer to your question is, we started feeling it even before the Monday Night Wars when Randy Savage came in. You know, a lot of that doesn't get reported, but even before Hulk came in, Savage came in, and Savage and Flair had a feud on top. And, you know, we were still just doing primarily southern cities, but I can remember one time in Greenville, we would average maybe 1,200 people there, and we had over 3,000. And everybody after the show was like, something's happening, you know. And then Hulk came in and, you know, celebrities came in. And then the crazy idea for doing live head-to-head that Eric made up off the top of his head, sitting in front of Ted Turner. And surprisingly, he said, okay. And so, you know, it got pretty cool, man. And I talk in the book at length. There's a whole chapter, I think, about at one point being pretty full of myself, you know, not, you know, kind of blowing off old friends and, you know, I think there was a quote in there that, you know, I didn't say this, but the guy took what my story and he came up with this great line. You know, the best man to my wedding and me to his was a guy named Lenny. And I think I wrote a line that says, who needs Lenny when you're riding with the horseman? So, right. Yeah, but, you know, the roar of the crowd is a powerful drug. And, you know, my only roar really was the first roar of the night. I got to go out and say, good evening, Minnesota, you know, and then the crowd pop. And, you know, that's, you know, you could call it, Mick Foley would call that cheap heat, and I'd agree with him. But hell, you know, why not take advantage of it? That was a way to get the crowd pumped up. We were in their city, you mentioned them by name. How you doing tonight? Are you ready for World Championship Wrestling? And, you know, that gets addicting. People talk about it, but I got to experience it. And when it goes away, it takes a while to get used to the fact that there's not that crowd pop anymore. Even when I was back in Impact after the pandemic ended and we were able to go back in front of audiences, which is a whole nother story that I'm sure will be at volume two of our book. But, you know, it's still, you know, still got a rise out of me, you know, good evening, Las Vegas, boom, you know, it's an aphrodisiac for sure.
Were you also, because I know you were living around the Atlanta area in this time as well. Did the lifestyle get to you as well? Like you're hanging out with the wrestlers in your spare time, getting dinner and stuff. And like that all kind of add to it also, like even like not even just the on screen, the pops there. It's like that whole lifestyle in general.
Yeah, I lived in Peachtree City. We hung out with the Benoits, which unfortunately is going to be another volume two story I'm going to have to tell. Grunges, Fit Finley's, Steven Regal's, and Dave Taylor. And then there was a guy who did was a cameraman for the company and his wife, who are still dear friends to this day. And there was that little group of us. And, you know, on a rare weekend off, we'd go out and get drunk and sing karaoke at the local Japanese place. And, you know, I remember taking Fit Finley to go see Tony Orlando because they had like a little amphitheater there. And, you know, they'd have all kinds of different acts, but you subscribe to the season package. And it was all golf cart pass. So you could ride your golf cart to the amphitheater. And what Fit Finley's like, I'm not going to see Tony Orlando. I'm like, he has some cool songs. And next thing I know, Fit Finley's, he'll kill me for saying this, singing Tie a Yellow Ribbon Around the Old Oak Tree. And, you know, so yeah, we had fun times and I missed those times. And, you know, we lost grunge and the Benoit thing aside, I kind of fell out of touch Regal, but the Finleys and then the other couple, who did the camera and also was a performer on one of the first wrestling albums, the one that Michael Hayes produced with the entrance music. His name was Darwin, and his wife was Jill, and still dear friends to this day.
I have two follow-ups, one related, one not quite as related. The first one, go-to karaoke song.
Oh, Can't Help Falling in Love with You.
Okay.
Elvis, you know, gets over the wife, you know, you kind of don't have to, you could be a shitty singer and still pull it off a little bit.
Well, karaoke, you know, it's all about, it's not how you actually sing, it's how you perform. The second question, you mentioned talking about the roar of the crowd and getting addicted to that. Did you ever want to fight Michael Buffer?
Not at all. Michael, everybody thinks I got heat with Mike Buffer. I nothing could be further from the truth. he, you know, look, I'm a capitalist. I believe in the American dream. I lived the American dream. I didn't live it to the extent that Michael Buffer lived it, but I could have if I would have come up with a catchphrase like that, I suppose, and been in the right place at the right time with the right execution. You know, it got the crowd going. You know, I couldn't have got the crowd going with a catchphrase like that, you know, but he was famous and he would say, you know, the whole buildup and then get ready to rumble and the crowd would go nuts. And how could I be angry with that? You know, he was super nice, always respectful, said something really nice. Haven't talked to Michael in a while, but my brother saw him about 7 years ago and said something really nice to my brother that I include in the book that I take as a wear of a badge of as a badge of honor. So yeah, no heat with Buffer at all. I mean, God bless him.
I didn't think you actually had heat with him, by the way. I was just trying to frame that question in a more fun way than
no. But a lot of people assumed that I was annoyed by it, right. And I wasn't annoyed by it. No, I wasn't annoyed by it at all. Look, this is for me. This was all about living my dream. I'm not going to worry about somebody else's dream. I'm not making $500 million and have my own video games and all that. And that's okay. But I've lived my dream for 30 years. And, you know, very few people get a chance to live their dream. So I can't complain about how others might have lived theirs better than mine. I mean, I never went there with anybody. It's always been about, you know, continuing the journey into something that I fell in love with when I was 11 years old and never thought I'd be involved in. So, so, you know, you call me the voice of your childhood. That's such an honor and it's so humbling, you know, because, you know, I was just trying to hang on to something that I fell in love with and see how long I could keep it going. So that's a super high honor for you to say that. And I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. I truly mean it. And, you know, I'm glad we were able to clear up, you know, officially, you are not annoyed by Michael Buffer, but somebody that you annoyed was Chris Jericho. And I remember this back in those
days. I still do.
I was gonna, two-part question. So this is perfect. First off, what was it like being a part of that storyline so early on in Chris Jericho's career? You had like a little mini feud with one another because you were announcing the people who were defeating him and he was throwing fits. And then the second part of that is, are you surprised or kind of what are your thoughts on like the fact that Chris Jericho is still on weekly television on the Turner networks to this day?
Pretty crazy. That was Chris's idea. Me and Chris riding down the road. He wanted to turn heel, chicken shit heel. And, you know, I would say that, you know, I threw a few ideas in, but it was 90% his thing. He would say, no, Penzer, I never used one thing you threw, one idea you had. You know, whether that's just Chris being Chris with me, I don't know or not, but that I'm pretty damn sure he would. But no, it was cool to be involved and people, you know, all of a sudden I sort of had an identity and instead of just a guy in the colorful bow ties and cummerbunds. And yeah, as far as Chris, man, you know, you could, you know, people like to talk about greatest of all times and, you know, you could argue stuff, but in my mind, Chris is by far the greatest of all time in recreating himself into so many different characters and gimmicks that make money, that are successful. You know, and it's the little things that he does that you don't even realize, like with our gimmick. He would, you know, tear off my tuxedo. Then he'd take my chair and he'd hit it against the ring post. And then the next week, he'd come out with a tuxedo and a chair. Well, the tuxedo jacket is nice because you did rip it. But like I'm in a building with like 5,000 chairs. You know, why do you have to bring me a chair? I've been sitting on a chair half the night. It's just those little things. It's the clicking of the pen before he said you're on the list. He made a clicking. Think about that. He made the clicking of the pen into a super pop. I mean, it's those little things that other people don't think of that really makes him stand out. And, you know, people could point to who you know, made singing along to people's entrance music cool again. But, you know, the Fozzy thing really, you know, took off in Judas and gave him new life, you know, and gave his band new life. God bless him. I mean, the song became synonymous with everybody in wrestling knew the words of the song. So just very smart guy, very talented, nice guy when he wants to be. I'm just kidding. He just likes to bust my chops. We get along better in smaller doses. I think I annoy him still to this day, like after a while. Like I went to his house for his for a party, a couple, because he lives about 10 minutes from me. And and we got along great. And then he invited me back for Sunday fun day the next night for football, the next day for football. And then, you know, after that, it was like, you know, maybe you should go away for a while. There's something about me annoys him in large quantities. So, you know, I'd rather keep it. Hey, we'll see each other every year and have a blast. Then we'll see each other every other weekend and not be friends anymore. And I'm not blaming him for that. There's just something about my personality that the longer he's around it, the more it annoys him.
Were there any other pitches, whether it was in WCW or TNA, and there was the famous moment with Kurt Angle, but were there any other pitches to anybody else, from anybody else, of like, hey, let me get like some heat on Penzer. This would be an easy way to make the crowd not like me.
Savage did something in his pay-per-view match with DDP for the world title, I remember. So that was a pretty big deal. Yeah, there were a few things. I remember one time the Giant picked me up by my lapels. I still have a picture of it. Right. And yeah, there was some stuff, but you know, not very often. And that was fine. I'm not an athlete, you know, and I don't want to roll around with those guys. You know, Kurt Angle, you know, pretty much was the cherry on top. And, you know, that was interesting. A few times, but it wasn't, you can't go to it too often. If you do, then it's just abusing the ring announcer and there's no heat there.
Now, sorry, Jeremy, you might be asking this also, but I just for people who may not know about the Kurt Angle thing that we're referencing, because I know you've talked about it plenty before, David, so I don't know how much you even want to like rehash it or if there's any like, I don't think you have any. Well, I'll let you speak on your own behalf. Essentially, what had happened for people who don't know, there was an angle where Kurt Angle attacked David Penzer on television, and he hits you with a brutal elbow to the face that legitimately swelled your face up bad. And yeah, can you just, I guess, talk about that? Because that was a very strange situation, like watching that as it happened.
Yeah, I look like the Elephant Man. He was very apologetic afterwards. He felt bad. I joke with him about it if I see him on the road at like a convention or something. But the issue was that I had another company that did airbrush tattoos at a pretty high level at one point. And they had a trade show in Atlanta that I was in Orlando. And I asked Jeff if I could be late for a couple tapings during this trade show. And he said, yes. So I rolled in about 5:30, 6 o'clock. TV started 7:30. We went over it a little bit, but he said in hindsight after the fact, that he laid it in cause he was afraid I wasn't going to sell it right because we didn't have time to go over it. And I know he feels bad about that, but part of me thinks that if the same thing happened today, he'd still lay it in because that's the way Kurt was. Kurt laid everything in. And I still think if he thought in his mind that the ring announcer is not going to sell my freaking elbow, I'm going to lay it in a little bit. I think he'd do the same thing tomorrow. And I don't think he'd apologize that he hurt me, but I don't think he'd be apologetic for, you know, wanting to get the right results.
And I think I've heard you talk about before that, like, that was the only thing out of that whole sequence that actually like landed and hurt, right? Like the ankle lock was safe. The he hit you with the shoe a whole bunch of times, but like,
yeah, the shoe to the cheek, yeah, to the other cheek that he didn't decimate. Yeah. He told me to put my hands over my head a certain way and I did. And he overswung, but, the ankle lock was fine. I think he clotheslined me. I didn't feel it probably cause my cheek had just been, decimated, by his, forearm. Yeah, I mean, at the time, you know, it wasn't the happiest day of my life, but, you know, I got a bonus. I got to miss a night of TV and still get paid. And, you know, it all healed and everything looks the same. And, you know, it is what it is. You know, if I complain about it, I sound like a crybaby and I don't want to be crybaby. You know, it happened and, you know, the world went on.
Well, for what it's worth, I believe I've heard, I'm almost positive it was Jeff Jarrett himself talking about this, maybe with Conrad, but I think he mentioned that like it was noticeable, like it stood out to people that you didn't complain after that. Apparently you just like, you took the lump and you just, you know, business was business. And like, that probably went a long way with a lot of people that like you didn't even complain because Kurt Angle, obviously massive star, probably the biggest name in the company at the time. And, you know, not to say that people should do that to one another, you know what I mean? But I think that it went a long way that like you didn't complain about it.
Where's that going to get me, though? You know, right. Where's that? There's not going to get me anywhere. Kurt Angle is the big star. I'm the ring announcer. That's not going to get me anywhere. So it's just going to get me heat with Kurt. So you just, you know, I got a bag of ice. I put it on my face and I got dressed and I drove home with a bag of ice on my face. And they sent me a nice bonus. And, you know, by the next week, you really couldn't tell. So, you know, it was uncomfortable. It hurt. But, you know, again, you know, this is the wrestling business. People get hurt, like legitimately hurt. You know, people get paralyzed, knock on wood, legitimately paralyzed. And I'm going to bitch because my cheekbone got hurt a little bit. That's just, you know, that's an easy way to find for them to tell you to find yourself a door.
Where they're going back to some pitches, you know, ring announcers have sometimes wrestled. Howard Finkel, of course, would have the tuxedo matches and everything. Were there any ideas for you to ever do a match?
I did one thing in Puerto Rico. We did an XWF invasion in Puerto Rico. And it was me and Jimmy Hart rolling around with the referee and the manager. And I never blew up so quick in my life. Gave me mad respect for how talented these guys are out that could go out there and even go 5 minutes. We weren't doing anything. We were just rolling around pretending to hit each other for a couple of minutes. I was the one who got pinned. But I was so blowed up. And Jimmy Hart's like, Pinzer, you're going to blow up out there. And I said, nah, we're just rolling around. I remember afterwards looking at Jimmy and saying, holy shit, you were right. But I didn't have any appreciation of it. There was a thing I did in Wildside Wrestling, Bill Barron's old company where AJ Styles and so many others started, where I came in as an arrogant heel ring announcer a couple times to their star young announcer. And you could still find that on Twitter. There's still video of that. And I've got to say, I was a pretty damn good heel. I sent it to Scott D'Amore when I first saw it on Twitter, and he wrote back. He goes, that was a damn good promo, Penser. That I enjoyed. That was like sort of like a bucket, checking something off the bucket list. The wrestling, not so much.
What are some of your more positive memories of TNA wrestling? Like we talked about, you know, the Kurt Angle thing just now, but like just being a part of TNA, and because they had great matches. I mean, for a long time there, they were really the main, you know, alternative to the WWE product in the United States. What was your time like? Just some positive memories of TNA wrestling, and then also your return to Impact years later.
Well, in WCW, I was emotionally invested for a lot of reasons. I was rising up the ranks. You know, I was Johnny Ace's assistant, and Johnny Ace was Eric's assistant. I was sitting in on booking meetings, coming up with ideas. You know, I was growing in the ranks, and there was not a plan B. I mean, there was WWF, where Howard Finkel and Tony Chimmel were, and there was no room for David Penzer, and then there was a WCW. So mostly I was invested in it when I didn't have I'd never done anything before other than drive a limousine to make extra money when I first started out driving guys up. I was a mobile DJ, but mobile DJs still get the same pay for 4 hours of work that they did when I was 20 years old. They just, it's easier because they don't have to carry the records around. But anyway, I digress. So I just didn't know what I was going to do to earn a living. When I was in TNA, as I mentioned, I had a successful company. And so if it all went away tomorrow, I wasn't emotionally invested in it. I wanted it to work for Jeff and Mike Tenay and those guys who were good friends. But it was sort of cool not to have to be walking on eggshells, you know, and if something goes wrong, you know, I wonder if the company's going to go out of business. I wonder if they're going to make cuts. You know, I didn't have to worry about that. So to me, it was just extra money and doing something I love. Some of my most vivid favorite memories are just sitting around the table in the executive offices of Universal backstage with Mike Tenay and Don West, and different people would come in. Jim Cornette, Bubba Ray Dudley, Kevin Nash would come in every taping, and so many other people, and just to tell stories with the guys. And Don obviously was over the top personality, one of my favorite people I ever worked with. You know, Mike's a great guy. And, you know, those guys are funny as hell, you know? So that was, you know, that for me was just sitting around that conference table and just being able to, like, you know, be a wrestling fan and listen to all these, this stuff was just without having to worry about, you know, if I was going to come back next week. I wanted to come back next week so I could sit around the table, less ring announcing. As far as Impact goes, that was weird. I came back a couple of times for short spurts, but, Scott called me during the pandemic and, like, very early on in the pandemic when, like, nobody knew if you were, like, everybody was going to die or not. And, you know, people were still wiping off their groceries before they brought them in the house, which in hindsight didn't make any difference. You know, and the first one I drove up because my wife didn't want me flying and there were very little flights. So that was an interesting experience in an empty arena with no fans. You know, it was a totally different way of doing things. Normally a pay-per-view, I would go out at 7:30 for an 8 o'clock show. I didn't welcome the crowd, hype them up, you know, tell them what they're going to see tonight, introduce, you know, the announce team, all that stuff. And the first or second or even third time that I just walked into an empty studio 5 minutes before the pay-per-view, put my earpiece on and sat in my chair was like the weirdest thing because it just, it's not natural. And, you know, for somebody who did it in front of fans for so long, I can't even, it probably was easier for like a new ring announcer who had never experienced that, but even must be tough. But it was strange, but it was nice when the fans came back and that was a crazy couple of years there. But yeah, I finished up with them in December and it was a great, if that's the last regular gig I have in this business, it was a great way to go out. They treated me fantastic. And you know, only thing I'm sad about is that Scott didn't last much longer than I did, which is a shame. But, you know, I don't know the details behind it, but it's just very sad.
Yeah. One follow-up I had about that, you mentioned Don West. Rest in peace, of course, to Don West. He was my favorite commentary team of all time is Mike Tenay and Don West. I've loved the two of them together. And I was a fan of Don West when he did the home shopping stuff with the baseball cards and stuff. I knew him as like that guy before he got into wrestling. So I was always like a really big fan of like his energy. He was always very entertaining, very passionate. Do you have any other like Don West stories you can throw out there for us?
Oh God, he's just so funny, you know, and he's, you know, there, I could count on two hands the number of people that I talked to and hang up. And when we hung up, I'd say, you know, love you, man. And they'd say, love you too. And Don West was one of those people. Super, super great guy. I remember when he turned heel on Mike Tenay, and everybody remembers this, you know, my wife and your wife are friends. And he you know, there's something about turning heel that just is fun. And I remember they, you know, went over that for weeks and, you know, they were ribbing each other about it, you know, about, you know, legitimately ribbing each other about, you know, Don would say something like when they were talking about it and then Tenay would go, I don't know, that's a little too close to home, man. And same thing, vice versa. So, but yeah, Don had a blast with it and just two wonderful people. I mean, so sad when we lost him and, but one of the best. I never saw the home shopping stuff live, but hey, when you're parodied on Saturday Night Live more than once, even once, yeah. I mean, that means you're doing something right. He was just that kind of guy, man. Super inventive, super funny, and just, you know, probably my favorite person in one of my top five favorite people in the wrestling business.
I want to ask, I don't know if you can say anything about it, but were you interviewed for the Who Killed WCW documentary that's coming out in less than a month now?
I was not. I was in talks with them about it, and they were interested in it. But I don't know if this was what I was told or if this is true, but at some point they had to just decide, you know, okay, these are the 8-10 people that we're going to interview, and I didn't make the cut, and I understood. It was no hard feelings. You know, if you got to pick between David Penzer and Eric Bischoff or David Penzer and Kevin Nash, you're stupid not to get, you know, the main guys, and not, you know, they were going to use me sort of as my book is, you know, as just a non-wrestler sitting there watching it all and what my perspective was. But they ended up cutting it. That was like one of the last cuts they made. And that's cool. I would have been excited to do it. But quite frankly, if you want to hear my take on it, just buy the book, Sitting Ringside Volume 1, DavidPenzerBook.com. It's basically what I would have said if I was on it. And I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Kind of on, along the same topic, and you may cover this in your book, but is it true that had Eric Bischoff purchased WCW and had not gone to Vince and the WWE, that like you were going to be a big part of the talent relations?
I don't know what my job would have been. I know that the plan was that, like I said earlier, John Laurinaitis was Eric's assistant, not like secretary, but assistant. When Eric wasn't there, because Eric wasn't there every taping, Johnny would run the show based on what Eric wanted him to do. I was John's assistant towards the very end, maybe the last 6-8 months. Eric had come up with a way to monitor the ratings. You know, the way the ratings were monitored got really, as time went on, got to the point where now you could like see almost minute by minute or match by match, you know, what fans were not watching and what fans were watching. And there, we created a metric for that. And my job for Eric and Johnny was for all the TVs to, once the ratings came out, is to put together a report on that. And, you know, Laurinaitis had said, and maybe it's a good thing it didn't happen. I still would have loved to have seen where that went. I'm supposed to be Eric's assistant. You know, nothing's guaranteed in this business or life, but I'm supposed to be Eric's assistant. I want you to be my assistant because you're doing a great job with this. Now, I know Johnny's full of crap a lot, but I honestly believe him when he said that. I think he saw, you know, in me someone who wanted to work hard and get to that next level of not just being the ring announcer, but someone who was involved in the office. And I don't know. I will say this, if that would have happened, there's not a doubt in my mind that I would have been a VP of something, you know, at some point in WCW. Now, you know, there's not a doubt in my mind. I was on my way. Now, you know, you can't say, you know, it didn't happen. So, you know, my story is different and it's even more interesting, I think. But I don't know about talent relations, but I would have been involved. I was involved in talent relations till the end.
David, as we start to wrap up here, I want to give you another chance to, of course, plug the book, plug everything you got going on with this. And I know this is volume one. Jensen, do you have one quick more?
I got one last question, just okay. Real quick, because it's a name you mentioned a handful of times. You mentioned Jody Hamilton. I got to interview his son. A lot of people don't even know it's his son, Nick Patrick. I interviewed him at a Deep South show. I guess it was late last year. Do you have any kind of relationship with Nick Patrick? Because I know you mentioned Jody Hamilton a whole lot.
Yeah. We talk on the phone every once in a while. We text and keep in touch via social media. He was the first podcast he was ever on to talk about the Sting Hogan Fast Count Slow Count was my Sitting Ringside podcast years ago. He gave me that exclusive, which really helped build that podcast brand, which was also called Sitting Ringside, ironically enough. But if you get a good name, you use it as many times as you can. But we stay in touch. His father was, you know, it's funny, one of my heroes in my childhood and then one of my heroes in my adult life for totally different reasons. And mad respect for that entire family. Always been nothing but great to me.
Again, I'm going to give a chance to plug the book with everything. It is Sending You Ringside. You can go to Amazon right now. You can go to DavidPenzer.com and get it. But this is labeled volume one. You've kind of mentioned a possible volume two coming down. Is there any updates on, have you already started kind of putting ideas together for what volume two might look like?
Yes, we're finally going to tell the story of the XWF that's never been told. I have those same treasure trove of WCW documents never before seen. I found business plan, extensive business plans and formats and all kinds of stuff from the XWF. So I want to finally tell that story. It's never been told. People always ask about it. You know, everybody in the Impact locker room towards the end, if the XWF would come up, it would be like all the guys, you know, because the guys are all in one locker room and the girls are another one. But all the guys would like hovering around. They wanted to hear about it. it's sort of like that lost story that ever got told. So we have all that with the bonus material. We'll talk about, obviously, TNA. Unfortunately, we have to talk about Benoit thing because I was super close to that. And, you know, being a Roddy Piper's tour manager for 45 days, crisscrossing the country on a tour bus with Roddy Piper, who, again, was one of my favorite wrestlers growing up. And then, the you know, TNA and Impact Wrestling and the pandemic. And we'll probably end around there. But it's just, you know, it was Guy's idea to do two books. He thought it was too much for one book. So this one's pretty much my ride into the business and in WCW. And the next one is sort of what happened from there, which was also improbable and impossible, but happened. And, you know, my luck streak continued.
Were you familiar with Guy's work on the first, I don't know, first, but like the Nitro book?
Yeah, he interviewed me a couple times for the book. We always hit it off. I noticed this the other day. I always read like little, you know, I skip around in the book and read like a couple pages at a time. I said, I wonder, I'll go back. And he thanks certain people like in like a little mini paragraphs and the acknowledgments. But the first person he thanks when he just lists people is me. I like to think that's because I made an impression on him. But I think he enjoys the way I tell stories and that my perspective as a fan, you know, watching this happen as a fan with the exclusivity that I had. We knew each other and I've read Nitro book. It's a fantastic piece of work. He got guys that forgot 20 years ago that took business people like that work for Turner Broadcasting that took off their resume ever working for a wrestling company because they were horrified by it. And not only did he find them, not only did he get them on the phone, but he got them to talk about something that they didn't want to talk about ever for the rest of their lives. I think he tells me it's the English accent. And maybe it is, but yeah, that's an excellent book. And again, you can get my book on Amazon, davidpenzerbook.com. It has all those bundles. You could go check those out and follow me at Twitter at David Penzer. And you guys be sure to tag me when you put this up so I could retweet it and tell everybody what a great job you did. And that SRS's cheese story is real.
And we appreciate that. Thank you for the kind words there. And I'm not as blowing smoke, like I said, David, a legitimate voice of my childhood. So this really was really, really cool for I know for myself and for Jeremy as well. So
yeah, we appreciate you.
Go ahead.
Oh, so we appreciate you joining us. I was going to let everybody know the links are below on this interview. So everybody can just click directly on the links and get to davidpenzerbook.com, Amazon to get it, or to follow David on social media.
Thanks. Thank you very much. You know, it's amazing how Fightful has really made a name for itself. And it's one of the top, no matter what Triple H says, the most respected wrestling journalism companies. I don't know what you would call it out there. And, you know, you guys get the scoop, almost all the scoops. It always amazes me. As a person who's never given a scoop to a wrestling journalist, unless when I was working for the XWF and I was in charge of talent relations and I did it on purpose because I wanted something to get out. But, you know, I was always taught that you don't do that. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but I always wonder where you guys get your sources. But it's always I'm always scrolling on Twitter and another big story coming out in 20 minutes. And I'm like, damn. So good for you guys. And I'm glad I got to come on and talk with you. I saw the boss for a minute and a half. And I'd love to be on again, you know, maybe when volume 2 comes out. Stay in touch.
Yeah, for sure. Again, that is all Sean doing all that kind of work. I just write headlines that upset a lot of wrestlers. So that's my job around.
Well, I could think of worse jobs.
Yeah. Hey, it works. Thank you again, David. We really appreciate it. Again, everyone, check out the links below. Go get the book. It's sitting ringside. It's on Amazon, davidpenzerbook.com. You get all the bundles, all the cool stuff. I mentioned it. I'll say it again with the production notes and the format sheets and everything. That's something that's you're not going to find anywhere else. And I think if you're a big fan of WCW, like Jensen and I are, like that's something that's you probably want to have in your collection. So thank you, David. We really appreciate it.
Had a blast. Thanks.
Thank you. Guys, we will be right back here on the Spotlight.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.